Last week, Americans United for Life represented those with a pro-life worldview on the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court and at pro-life events around the city and nation. We don't yet know what the outcome of the case will be, but there is much to celebrate and much to speculate. Join Katie Glenn, Steve Aiden, and I as we recap the week's events. I'm Anna Claire Noblett, and you're listening to Life, Liberty, and Law. Welcome back to Life, Liberty, and Law, brought to you by Americans United for Life. I always like to say that. It sounds like a commercial or something, kind of funny, but I am excited to have Katie and Steve back with us 2 weeks in a row. We got to talk to them right before the oral arguments in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health, and now we have a lot to look back on and more information to talk about. So, Katie and Steve, thanks for joining me again today, and I'm just excited to hear your thoughts after a big week.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, terrific. Thank you, Anna Claire.
Well, Steve, why don't you just jump in? I know you've been giving a lot of interviews this week, but what are your initial reactions to the oral arguments last Wednesday morning?
Yeah, Anna Claire, there has been a lot of anticipation building up to this oral argument. I think it met even our wildest expectations. It was the most open and honest Supreme Court oral argument on abortion I've ever heard. They were talking about ultimate questions, not only about the overturn of Roe, but about the role of religion, the validity of medical science, reliance interests asserted by Casey, the history of abortion. Everything was out there. All the elephants in the room were called out and thrown on the table. It's the debate that we should have had in the Supreme Court decades ago, and I'm really, really grateful that we had it last week.
That's amazing. Well, something I'm seeing a lot is, you know, this question of what role does politics play in the Supreme Court, right? And a lot of accusations, honestly, of, you know, politics being just intertwined, especially when it comes to justices who are open about being pro-life. But Katie, what role did politics play last week? Could you see kind of an improvement away from this accusation that, oh, this, the court has gotten so political? Where are we on that scale?
Well, I think, you know, a couple of the justices spoke to this issue a little bit. Justice Sotomayor, who makes no bones about where she's at on this case, you know, said there will be a stench of politics on this court if we overturn Roe v. Wade. You know, I think Steve probably agrees with me that we think there has been a stench of politics on this court since Roe v. Wade, precisely because in that case, the justices waded into the policymaking space. And that's something that sort of fit the tone of some of the questions asked by Justice Kavanaugh, where he asked, you know, isn't it more appropriate for the legislature to be drawing these types of lines? I was listening earlier to the Commentary podcast, which I highly recommend for our listeners too. And they were talking about how the role of a justice is more like a referee. And, you know, the Chief Justice has referenced this is about calling balls and strikes like a referee. But in this context of Roe, for a long time, the court has been putting its thumb on the scale and making those policy decisions. So I think the best thing the court could do to get out of politics would be to overturn Roe and send it back to the states. And that's certainly what Scott Stewart with the state of Mississippi argued.
Yeah, and Justice Breyer, Katie, wow. Relying totally on that political question and arguing really to the other justices, not really asking a question, but making an argument, particularly to the Chief Justice, that they can't overturn Roe because there's been too much reliance built up on it. It's too politically controversial, and that the court would lose a lot of its legitimacy if it overturned Roe. He sounded desperate to me. He didn't even try to defend abortion either as a practice or the abortion jurisprudence of Roe. So I like where we are in this debate after last Wednesday in the court. Don't know where the court is going, but I think they're going in the right direction, frankly.
Well, and Steve, as you mentioned, you know, Justice Breyer not really defending Roe necessarily on the merits of what it stands for, but more just saying, well, you know, this is going to be very political if we do this. It seemed to me that the advocates for Jackson Women's, the abortion clinic that sued, and for the United States government, both were sort of just resting on this idea of precedent. They weren't really digging into the merits of why Casey was correctly decided or why they should win. They were just saying, well, this has been the case for a really long time. Wouldn't want to disrupt, you know, the precedent. Whereas our colleague Clark and you as well have written extensively about the idea that something being around for a long, long time does not make it inherently good or legally correct. So I wonder if you could go into that a little bit more.
Sure. I mean, stuck in the 70s is what they are when they argue that Roe is a fundamental right. It's a precedent upon precedent. It's super precedent. The truth is, Roe is a shattered hulk. It's a shadow of its former self. The court would do everybody a favor if it tipped it over and gave it a rest. I'm just astonished that they seem to be mired in this view that abortion is a super right and that no, there's no legislative authority to call it into question. And the court, the majority of justices in the court last Wednesday weren't having any of that. They were very skeptical of the abortion industry's views presented by Julie Reichelman of Center for Reproductive Rights, and they wanted to have that honest dialogue. And I don't think that Reichelman or the Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar came to prepared to have that argument.
Steve, talking about precedent, help me understand when it is necessary to base a decision off of precedent and when it is not, because we have overturned cases throughout the history of our country. So why should this one not be made on the basis of stare decisis?
Yeah, you're so right, Anna Claire. I mean, over 230 times the U.S. Supreme Court has overruled itself. So it's nothing new. It's fairly routine that the court will correct errors of law or a judgment that it's made and recognize that, you know, you can't perpetuate a mistake. People say, you can't overturn Roe because it's too political. It's too controversial. I think that's the best argument for overturning Roe. If the only reason that you're hanging on to a case is because you're afraid of the political consequences, that to me makes it a political question. And the court needs to get out of the area of politics. It would help the Supreme Court judicial nomination process, which is in shambles after the nomination of Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Barrett. Hardly anybody respects that process. It would help the states, because politically that's where controversial issues belong. They belong with the people and in the states, not subject to the arbitration of nine men and women in black robes.
Well, and for many lawyers who are, you know, kind of in this space that Steve and I and all of us at AUL occupy, one of our favorite decisions is the court overturning itself in the Barnett case from 1943, where 3 years before that, the Supreme Court had significantly curtailed the religious rights of students in public schools. And then just 3 years later, they came back and said, in almost identical circumstances, even down to it being the same religion, but all the kids involved in this were Jehovah's Witness, to say we got it wrong. And in fact, you don't, you know, stop having religious freedom rights just because you walk through the door of a public school. So I think we need the court to have that kind of humility anytime it gets it wrong. And, you know, many of us who, you know, have done religious freedom, as both of us have had, or in this pro-life space, you know, really point to that as a great opinion. So that's the kind of thing that it shouldn't be, oh, if you overturn yourself because the court got it wrong the first time, you're going to be punished for that. Should be, no, we're celebrating the depolitization of the Supreme Court by having the humility to do that.
Yeah, and there's a great story, by the way, in that decision that affirmed the right of religious children, if their beliefs taught that, not to salute the flag, which they did. They considered it idolatry. Jehovah's Witnesses were being jailed. Their children were being taken away from them. They brought the question of the flag salute to the U.S. Supreme Court no less than 7 times before the case that you're referring to, which is the Barnett case. The first 6 times, the court refused to hear them, and they kept coming. Finally, on the 7th time, the court agreed to hear them, Minersville versus Gobitis, and the court ruled against them and said that the country had a right to force people to salute the flag, and there's no First Amendment right not to. But they kept coming, and finally, on that last case, they convinced the court that the right of conscience is more important than a false sense of national security. That's a good lesson for the whole pro-life movement, I think. We are just going to keep coming and keep knocking on that door until it's open.
So interesting. It's totally possible. Our country is full of those necessary reversals. I mean, from Brown to Plessy and all, I mean, like you're saying,
And now that you mention it, there was discussion in the Supreme Court about one of those necessary reversals. And it was so heartening to hear the Chief Justice airing out the view that Roe is like the Plessy case. The Plessy case was the case from the late 1800s that said separate is equal. And that was overturned, of course, by the Supreme Court in Brown versus Board of Education in 1952, when they finally declared, no, separate is not equal. And Plessy is hereby overturned. So the Chief Justice says, and this is a quote, "There was a lot of reliance on Plessy. The South built up a whole society based on the idea of white supremacy. So there was a lot of reliance. It was improper reliance. It was reliance on an egregiously wrong understanding of what equal protection means." Well, if that's not a signal which way his mind and heart are leaning about Roe, I don't know what is. And again, to hear the justices and the advocates talk about Roe as if it's one of the most hated constitutional precedents of all time, Plessy, which begged to be overturned and finally was, man, that was so encouraging. That was really, really good.
Well, and Justice Barrett spoke really well to that reliance interest question as well. You know, for our listeners who aren't as familiar with this, a reliance interest is one of the factors that courts consider when they're determining whether to overturn a precedent. So they think about how people have used the outcomes of this decision, the policy that flows from this decision, to order their lives. Like, how much
like
are
how
people...
How society has morphed based like around the new decision?
Yeah, because the idea is that we don't want courts just flipping things 180 degrees and people have an understanding that something is available to them or you know, something is legal or not legal, and all of a sudden it's changed and they don't have notice of that. They're not anticipating that. It's something that the justices spoke a lot about in Casey, where they said a whole generation of women and men, but they really drove home on women, have ordered their lives. They've made decisions around this idea that if they get pregnant and they don't want to be pregnant, they don't have to be. They can get an abortion and they don't have to be pregnant anymore. And Justice Barrett, who is in fact an adoptive mom herself, really sort of exposed the lie even of what the pro-abortion side's talking about. Is it a right to not parent, or is the right to not be pregnant? When she talked about, you know, accessibility of adoption, the fact that in the 30 years since Casey, every single state has passed a safe haven law so that a person can terminate their parental rights and that child can find another home. And, you know, obviously that situation is born from a tragedy. Anytime a child is not with their mom and dad, that there's a tragedy there. But there's also an opportunity in those situations. And I think, you know, her questions really pointed to the idea that if this, you know, so-called right is grounded in the idea of not parenting, our society has done a lot in the last 30 years to provide for that. And, you know, I think the attorneys arguing against that position were like, no, no, that's not what this is about. This is about a woman not having to be pregnant, and kind of were shifting where they were at. And I think, you know, that's the kind of question that the justices did dig into a little bit more when they said, well, if the woman has a right to not be pregnant, how does the viability line change that? You know, like, if wouldn't that extend throughout pregnancy? And they said, no, 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 we're staying with viability. It really exposes how well, like, you know, this doesn't make sense. It doesn't all fit together. And I know, Steve, you have been following this and arguing these types of cases for years. So I wonder how, you know, you as somebody who has been in court defending pro-life laws, like what you make of that, and whether you think that there is a path forward that doesn't include overruling Roe completely, because it felt like that's the only logical endpoint here.
Yeah, it's difficult to conceptualize a standard that isn't an overturn of Roe, Katie, and a lot of commentators have struggled on that difficulty. That's why I think both sides of the argument in the Supreme Court really seem to treat it like a zero-sum game. It's either Roe or nothing. That's good rhetorically for our side, because I think if a majority of the court had to make a decision, they would make a decision to throw Roe out. But I think the reason is that it's very difficult to find a middle ground here. I mean, the court tried to do that in Casey at viability, but the argument that you and I heard on Wednesday strongly suggests that a majority of the court recognized now that viability was always artificial. It didn't make any sense as a constitutional line. Justice O'Connor famously called it a standard on a collision course with itself because it was dependent on medical technology. So the most encouraging thing, I think, about the argument last week for me was to hear the Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts, pushing back on Julie Reichelman for Jackson Women's Health Organization and saying, when do you stop relying? Do you stop relying? You don't stop relying at 8 weeks or 12 weeks or 15 weeks. In fact, all throughout pregnancy, you talk about this, but isn't 15 weeks a reasonable standard that the vast majority of other countries have? And he cited to evidence that friends of ours have provided the court that that Roe makes the U.S. extreme. It's in bad company with anti-humanitarian nations, not very many of them, seven of them actually, and they include China and Vietnam. That's a breath of fresh air. And it was, I would have thought before last week that it would have been courageous for any member of the court to even question the sacred cow of the abortion industry, reliance on abortion for women to succeed at any stage of pregnancy. But the Chief Justice was calling it out and even mildly mocking it. Just tremendous.
Yeah, I agree. It's very, very exciting and bold, like you said, because even though the justices are supposed to be separate from politics, they are in no way protected from the firestorm of politics. And yeah, so I was blown away as well. So explain a little bit about, you know, we're talking about overturning Roe. You said last week that the main question is every pre-viability restriction unconstitutional? So correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is overturning Roe gives the rights back to the states to decide how their state is going to restrict or not restrict abortion. Would every federal standard for abortion restrictions be wiped away then?
Well, of course, it depends on what the court does. There was a lot of talk about doing away with the viability line of Casey, and so Justice Thomas asked the Solicitor General for Mississippi, Scott Stewart, what would replace the rule in Roe if we did away with that? And General Stewart appropriately said, well, every law is judged by the rational basis standard. We have to be governed by laws that are not arbitrary or capricious. And that's the standard that would govern any abortion law. And he's right. I think that that's appropriate because I think that limitations on the destruction of human life are eminently reasonable. And I think that's a very good principle to adhere to for all of us going forward. And I hope that that's what they come out with.
Yeah. So, Katie, moving forward, I know that states, like you said, they just have to be prepared because we don't know what is going to happen, right? So how are you working with states to prepare for kind of our best case scenario where they would get to decide the future of abortion restrictions in their state?
Well, certainly, what do you want your state to look like after Roe is a conversation that we've been having more and more all the time. And certainly that has, you know, just exponentially increased since this case was granted in May. But lawmakers have been thinking about it for a while. And, you know, nobody wants to be that member who works really hard and champions their bill through the state house and gets to see it knocked down in the district court and never enforced. And so there have been members who, or leadership in particular in states where they say, what's the point if it's going to get struck down by the courts? They're thinking that less and less. We saw really bold action this year. Nearly 100 pro-life laws were enacted. And these are substantive bills. You know, Texas obviously had the first heartbeat law to go into effect. But last week, with very little attention, because it was the day after Roe, Texas also had a chemical abortion law go into effect that limits chemical abortion drug usage to the first 7 weeks of pregnancy in that state. And we really expected a legal challenge, but the other side didn't sue. So that law went into effect on December 2nd, and we'll see what happens with it.
Wow.
But, you know, there are things like that. The states are passing these conditional laws or constitutional amendments like Louisiana did in 2020, and Kansas has on the ballot later this year, and other states will be pursuing next year. So there really is, you know, this idea, whether you are pro-life or pro-choice, like, we need to be thinking about what do we want our laws to look like in a post-Roe world. And certainly I've noticed a really, you know, significant shift in the way that reporters ask me those questions. They are certainly thinking about what comes next. So, you know, Americans United for Life, we've been a 50-state organization for 50 years, and we will keep doing that. We think the great thing about being pro-life is that it is, you know, something that we can pursue legislatively all over the place. And in every single state, there are opportunities, whether it is with end-of-life care and the elderly, or with young children providing information. A couple states passed laws providing women with information if they get a Down syndrome diagnosis in the womb, saying these are the resources that exist in our state. We want you to know about them, and doing that in English and Spanish so that it maximizes, you know, women understanding and families understanding that information in their first language. That's totally the kind of thing that we are going to keep encouraging states to do. And I think those are the types of policies that even in, you know, hardcore pro-abortion states, there should be an opportunity for common ground there.
That's so true. So true, Katie. You know, we were built for this, AUL was. We've been doing this for 50 years, and we will keep doing it. Our message to the states is we expect the Supreme Court to overturn Roe, but even if they don't, it's full steam ahead. You've passed hundreds of pro-life, life-saving bills in the last 10 years. Keep on doing what you do, and we will overcome.
Yeah, thank you, Katie.
Well, and if the court does less than Roe, you know, there are already 40-plus cases circulating throughout the federal courts. There are a couple big cases at the state level as well. I think there will be infinitely more. If the court goes short of overturning Roe, there will be all these states that want to rush into court and say, we want to defend our laws again under this new standard. And we saw Arkansas do that in 2020 In 2021 with success after the Supreme Court handed down their ruling in June Medical Services, Arkansas said, we've got these four laws, they're enjoined. We think under the new test, they can be enforced. And two of the four went into effect. So I think the idea that if the court does something less than Roe, it will just solve this problem and wash their hands of it, that is absolutely not true. I think there will be more court cases than ever. And Steve, as a litigator, you may have more to say about that.
No, that's very true. And we will be right there with them to equip them and give them the facts and the law that they need to succeed. Roe is going down soon, if not in this case, then one very soon. I think it's high time that we stop talking about the court chipping away at Roe. We're well past that point. Roe's really been hacked to pieces over nearly 50 years as the Supreme Court has like furiously backpedaled from the extreme right of abortion it created out of thin air in Roe. I mean, like, Roe is a ghost ship. It's a derelict. It's crewed by the memories of what it once was. And you heard the advocates last Wednesday talking like they're still in the 70s. It's like a bad movie. The future is pro-life, and we're ready and anxious to help the states lay the foundation for that pro-life future.
Yeah, I'm just ready for the law to reflect the American people again. I mean, I know there's some loud, loud voices yelling against us and for abortion, and we have, like we've talked about, I mean, we want to disarm this reliance interest argument because we want to empower the people who have been hurt by abortion, who have been coerced, who have been told lies about their capabilities and their identity. And their identity in relationship to other human lives and their responsibility to other human lives. So I know we do have a pro-life majority that does not agree with the way things are right now. And so it's time for those things to be realigned again and for our federal law and for the Supreme Court to represent, you know, to reflect at least the hearts of the American people. And we'll keep having conversations that hopefully change hearts and minds one by one.
It's been funny to see exactly what you're saying in the last couple of days. I know Politico and the New York Times and a couple of other big outlets have been writing like, hey, Democrats, your ideas aren't that popular. And for a long time, you know, politicians have been able to say like, rah, rah, keep Roe. And that's, you know, their pro-choice platform. But when you actually look at things like the Women's Health Protection Act that our boss, Catherine Foster, testified against in the Senate, where it would extend abortion throughout pregnancy and taxpayers would pay for it, and it would remove health and safety laws. And even if there was something horrific that happened in your community, you could not pass a law to stop that kind of thing or punish that doctor. Like, people don't like this. And, you know, the New York Times had polling where they said 70% of people want to keep Roe. But when you ask them, like 70% of people also would limit abortion at 12 weeks, which is not what Roe did. So I think, you know, we are starting to see coverage where it's like, if Roe is off the table and this truly becomes a political and policy issue, we will be much closer to where Americans are, which is pro-life, or some abortions, you know, closer to the first trimester, but certainly not throughout pregnancy, you know, where most of Europe and most of the world is at. I think that's where we would come in. And that's what certainly politicians who have been, you know, sort of pounding the pavement, saying abortion on demand, are now realizing that people are not with them.
And politicians have to respond to the people. And so I feel like a lot of people are in the gray here where they just don't have the information or kind of the passion one way or another. And so that's why opportunities like Supreme Court cases are so amazing, is because we get the opportunity to put the information out there, to stake our claim on what's really happening, to tell the truth, so that people who are normally just, you know, kind of casually scrolling through the news are faced with this really fundamental belief about what it means to be human and about what it means to be American. And we start to have a little bit more traction for people to say, oh, well, this is what I actually think, instead of just being passive about it. So I think it doesn't take much really to shift something, I mean, we see trends go up and down all the time, right? In every industry, but even for something as important as this, I really think that, you know, the popularization of some of these really great claims that we're making about women's capability and the innate value of every person, like, I'm hoping those start to catch on, because why wouldn't they be popular, you know? And then politicians have to respond to what the people, you know, are asking them to do. So I feel like it won't take much more maybe to really show Washington what the American people believe and care about and change a little bit. So very hopeful. I'd love to hear how each of you are trying to get a little bit of rest, maybe what you did this weekend. I know we normally do a shot of gratitude and we'll do that, but how have you been recovering after this week? What's something fun that you've either done or you're hoping, you're looking forward to?
Well, I will say between Thanksgiving and then heading to DC immediately for a week of oral arguments and all the activities around that, I got home to Florida. I went to Publix and filled my fridge with fresh food. And then I had a dance class on Saturday. My boyfriend and I are taking ballroom dancing lessons.
Fun. A good change of scenery.
Yeah, yeah. Good to get off the phone and get moving.
What about you, Steve?
Yeah, same here, Anna Claire. Spending time with my family. Music, reading, it's been good. How about you?
No ballroom dance lessons?
No, I'm too left feet on the food.
Yeah, I definitely lied low this weekend and got to just spend some great quality time with friends before we all head off for the holidays and take our, do some final projects, final exams. But yeah, let's go around the horn and give a shot of gratitude real quick, and I'll let y'all get back to your day. So I will go first. I am thankful for community and thankful for, like I said, a lot of people are in the gray on this. And I think my unique position as a student has given me the opportunity to start conversations with people who haven't formed their opinion on abortion yet, and have some friends who are really curious. And we're hoping to start a Students for Life group on my campus. Just thankful for a community of curiosity and a time to interact with students who are trying to figure out where they stand on this issue.
Well, I was outside at the court on Wednesday, and I'm really excited to report that I think for the first time ever, we had more pro-life than pro-choice advocates out on the sidewalk. And even the Washington Post said 3 to 4 times as many pro-life. They probably said the anti-abortion, but that's okay. And so I'm just really grateful for the entire pro-life movement. You know, Justice Sotomayor said during oral arguments, this is a religious thing, isn't it? And if she was out on the sidewalk, she would see that's clearly not true, because we had secular pro-life and, you know, New Wave feminists and all these different groups that are secular, including ours is secular, or, you know, explicitly non-religious, to say this is a moral and ethical stain on our nation. This is, many of us come to this from faith, but this is also about embryology. I think my favorite sign out there said, this comes from the good book, and it was like a textbook, like an embryology textbook. I thought that was pretty funny. So I'm just really grateful for the pro-life movement and how it is such a big tent. And so many people come to this from all different reasons and experiences and walks of life. And, you know, there are people out there in their 80s, and we had over 1,000 college students. It was just really, you know, kind of reminded me of the March for Life, and was really like restoring my soul of like being really tired after weeks of lots of work to just get to see everybody and be out there with them.
Yeah, so true. You know, Anna Claire, I love the sound of Christmas bells. And this is the season for them. I'm reminded of Winston Churchill in 1942, when he saw that the tide was turning in favor of the Allies in the war against Hitler. He said, "Ring out the bells. This is not the end. It's not even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning. The end has been a long time coming for legal abortion in America. So let's ring out the bells in expectation and gratitude that it will soon be a fading memory."
Absolutely. Well, we do have a lot to celebrate, especially with Christmas coming, and we'll all get some rest soon, but please be proud and just know that you have so many people who are very thankful for the work that you're doing at AUL and on behalf of so many life supporters. So thank you all for joining us, and thanks to our audience for being in there with us. Please engage with us on social media and stay updated on Americans United for Life's website for more resources of all kinds and on the work of these two amazing people. So thank you so much, Katie and Steve.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks, Santa Clara.
If you enjoyed the show, please give us a rating on Apple Podcasts, leave us a review wherever you listen, and tell a friend about us. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, drop us an email at life@aul.org. I'm Anna Claire Noblett. Until next time, thanks for listening to Life, Liberty, and Law and supporting Americans United for Life.